Thanks for tuning in to KCPW and the special broadcast of a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune editorial cartoonist Pat Bagley, recorded last week at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City. The event was part of a year-long collaboration between KCPW, the Salt Lake Tribune, Utah Public Radio, and Utah Humanities as part of the Pulitzer Prize's Centennial Campfires initiative. That initiative seeks to illuminate the impact of journalism and the humanities on American life today, to imagine their future, and to inspire new generations to consider the values represented by the body of Pulitzer Prize-winning work. Pat Bagley, by the way, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in 2014. You'll hear mention of Bagley's cartoons throughout the broadcast, and for your reference, those can be found at kcpw.org. We'll send you now to Salt Lake Tribune editor and publisher Terry Orme for an introduction.
Good evening. My name is Terry Orme. I'm the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, and thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thanks for that. I don't think you're clapping for me. I think you're clapping for the Tribune. Thank you. Tonight we are here to celebrate the power of the pen, and we're here to talk to an individual who does pretty well with that pen and does some pretty powerful stuff with that pen. Tonight's event is the first in a series of events that celebrates the centennial of the Pulitzer Prizes, the highest award in journalism, and an award that also in different disciplines celebrates the written word and celebrates art. We are joined in this endeavor by three partners. The first partner is Utah Humanities, and I want to point out Cynthia Buckingham, who's back in the back. Cynthia, you got to stand up and take a bow. Cynthia is the executive director of Utah Humanities. Our other partners in this venture are KCPW, Salt Lake radio station, and Utah Public Radio in Logan. Pat Bagley joined the Salt Lake Tribune in the late 70s, and he soon became what many people would consider to be the Salt Lake Tribune. When people think about the Tribune, they oftentimes think about Pat Bagley. And he's also, in 2014, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. We at the Tribune keep predicting that one day, one year, he will no longer be a finalist, but he will be the winner. So, without further ado, I want to introduce the man of the hour, who will be joined later in the program by our Trip Talk host, Jennifer Napier Pierce, but that will be later. And also, I want to say, after we're done in here with this conversation, we want to continue the conversation out there with some food and drink. And please stick around and join us for that. But now I want to introduce again the man of the hour, Pat Bagley.
Thanks, Terry. I gotta say that the other night I spoke to a group full of Utah legislators. They were not nearly as kind as you are. I mean, I look out here and I see a bunch of Bernie Sanderses. I was reminiscing with Jennifer before we began about one of my first opportunities to speak to people after becoming the cartoonist at the Salt Lake Tribune. And it was at the Little America, and the ballroom was full, and I was trying to think of something funny to say, and I was just from BYU, and, you know, my humor wasn't quite developed yet. And so I got up there and I just absolutely botched it. You know, I don't even want to relive how bad it was, but it was that bad. And as I was leaving, these people, you know, behind me were talking. They didn't know that I was ahead of them. And they said, well, his humor's visual. So I actually probably got started on my career by watching my father. My father was very politically engaged. We always had the television on to the news. We always had newspapers. We had Time Magazine and Newsweek. He was always reading. But he was also sitting in front of the television set doodling. And he was sketching people on the TV. He was doing caricatures. And so I grew up thinking that everybody's father, you know, did cartoons. So he demystified the process for me. And I always liked that. I always tended to go there. My mother was very practical, and she said, the only kind of artist is a starving artist. So when I went to BYU, I took political science and history. You know, not really good courses if you want to find gainful employment. I was looking at maybe going to law school later and being a lawyer, being an attorney. But I got sidetracked. I was sitting in a class, and the class had to do with personal finance, and it was deadly dull. But I remember, you know, taking notes, and then I started to sketch this idea, and it kind of blossomed into this cartoon. So I took the cartoon to the Daily Universe, and I thought they would have their cartoonist, Steve Benson, some of you may know who he is, I thought they would have him do it. But they said, no, go home and do a final copy. And I did, and they put it in the paper the next day, and I was hooked. You know, after seeing your stuff in print like that, you know, I knew what I was going to do after that. And the upshot of that story is that that same cartoon got picked up by Time Magazine. So the very first cartoon I had published went to Time Magazine, and it's been downhill ever since. Okay, there it is. There's Bella Abzug. We're of an age where we remember her. She's being escorted by the National Guard, and there's this guy in the apartment saying, hey guys, our new roommate is here. So the Daily Universe ran this cartoon, and they got all kinds of response to it. And it wasn't about the content of the cartoon. It was the fact that Farrah Fawcett, that poster was on the wall. So I got the job at the Daily Universe. I did cartoons for almost a year. I started looking around. The Salt Lake Tribune was one of the last large newspapers that did not have a cartoonist. And so I pitched my stuff, and initially I was turned down, but because of some internal Tribune politics, somebody hired me to spite somebody else. And so that's how I got on with the Tribune. So this is my very first cartoon at the Salt Lake Tribune. And if I recall right, this is November 1st, 1978. And this is when they were doing the redevelopment downtown, and they were putting in the fancy trash containers and the tree things. And so this is how old we are, I am. Is I wanted to show a hoodlum. Okay? So very first Tribune cartoon, November 1st, 1978, Day of the Dead. Appropriate. Okay. Let's go to the next one. Okay, do you guys remember that Channel 2 makes no difference where I go, you're the best place that I know. Hello, Utah. Come on. Hello, Utah. So this is during the MX missile thing and the cruise missiles and the wet eye. Does anybody remember that? That was the nerve agent that they had out at Dugway. Okay? I mean, we were a repository of all this just horrible stuff. Radioactive waste as well, still there. One of my proudest achievements early in my career, I think, was this cartoon. They recently had, I think it was This American Life, did a story about that little ditty. And I thought it was just Utah, but it apparently appeared all over the country. Okay, let's go to the next cartoon. Okay, here you see this Mormon family, and the wife is barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen, and all these little kids are running around, and the guy is in his easy chair, and he's reading a newspaper that says, Utah population booms in the 70s. And he's saying to his wife, honey, it's hard to imagine that kind of growth in just 10 years. So they published this cartoon, you know, these kids running around, they're 4, 5, 6, 7, I don't know. And we got all kinds of response to it. We got lots of letters, you know, complaining about this. They weren't complaining about the wife barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. They were complaining about the picture of the temple is crooked. Okay, going to BYU is kind of like having an LSD trip. I almost said LDS trip. Because things come up and you relive it. I mean, just this last week, the president of Iran visited Italy. And maybe you've heard the story, is that they covered up some of the nude statuary so that he wouldn't be exposed to it. Well, this brings me back to BYU. And I did this cartoon when the Rodin exhibit was hosted by BYU, and they kept some of the statuary behind closed doors locked up because they're afraid that the nudity might incite something. I don't know. So kind of the same thing. So here you see this BYU administrator pointing towards the Rodin, the thinker, very famous sculpture. Okay, this one can stay, but I want the offending portion covered. And in the second frame, you see a BYU student looking at the Rodin exhibit, the thinker, and the thinker has a paper bag over his head. I've got to explain these because there are people listening on the radio and they can't see this. Okay, so this brings me to the thing that makes Utah most unique and why I think I'm irreplaceable. Because I don't know any other cartoonist in the country who could, you could put, set him down in Salt Lake City, set him down in Utah, and he would have a clue about the culture. Okay, let's go to the next cartoon. Okay, this is Larry King Live. This is when Gordon B. Hinckley became president of the LDS Church. And he was unique in that he was very media savvy. Before Hinckley, the leadership of the church was very averse to any media engagement. They just didn't get out there. But Gordon B. Hinckley, you know, he was really good at this. And so he went on 60 Minutes, and he went on Larry King Live, and he was very available and very open. And so I'm sitting there at the Salt Lake Tribune thinking, you know, I'm not sure that it's allowed to do a cartoon of the prophet. Something bad might happen. But I thought, you know, the guy's out there, he's in the public eye, you know, he's fair game. And so I did this cartoon where Gordon B. Hinckley is on Larry King Live, and Larry King is saying, when we return, more of Mormons, ordinary people just trying to become gods. You know, again, this is one of those that got a lot of response from you know, people saying, you know, this is just sacrilegious, you shouldn't be doing this kind of stuff. But what I learned from this experience is that there are any number of people who are willing to be offended on behalf of those at the top. Because I heard later that Gordon B. Hinckley, of course, saw the cartoon, and he kind of liked it, you know. And you got to admit, he looks kind of cute, right? Okay, but it's not only Mormons that can get a little upset about their religion being cartooned. Let's go to the next one. Okay, here you see Pope John Paul II, and he's in the Pope Mobile. But he's being driven in the opposite direction of orthodoxy by American Catholics, who are notoriously kind of lax. And the woman who's, you know, in the front has got a little map of Disneyland, and she says, do you hear something? It sounds like it's coming from the back. And you see John Paul II, you know, pounding, trying to get their attention so that they go back towards orthodoxy. Well, John Paul II came to America, and it was a big deal. You know, everybody did a cartoon about John Paul. And so I did, too. And this is what I did. Well, I heard from my publisher, who was a very devout Catholic, that I was not to do any more cartoons of the Pope. Because it was just sacrilegious. So, of course, when he retired, I did another cartoon of the Pope. Okay, the next cartoon is probably the best one I've ever done regarding this issue. So here you see, it's that thing that I've kind of made famous. It's a meme where you see a church official in the office building, in the back, through the window, you see the temple. And this guy's at the desk, and he's on his phone, and he says, "Sister Finchley, I'm tired of these stories in the media that say the church calls all the shots in Utah. Have the legislature pass a resolution denying it." You know, I love this setup where, you know, you have somebody in the church office building and you see the temple in the background, because it is so rich for material. You know, this is one of the great things about being a cartoonist in Utah, is that it's just the easiest job in the world. Let's go to the next one. You know, I do give Mormons, you know, I'm kind of hard on them, but, you know, things go both ways. So here's a cartoon where there are two couples. You see a very clean-cut Mormon couple, and then you see another couple that are tattooed, and they're smoking and you know, just very bizarre looking. And that couple is saying to the Mormon couple, "You Mormons are so bizarre." Okay, let's go to the next one. You know, we just had the Sundance Film Festival. Well, this is the Utah remake of the Hitchcock classic called The Birds. And here you see a lot of strokes with babies, you know, and the woman's just go, "Oh, no." Okay, the next cartoon. Okay. With what's going on in Harney County, you know, Burns, Oregon, with the, you know, occupiers, the militia. This goes way back. I mean, this is when I was first at the Tribune and there was the Sagebrush Rebellion. So it's the same thing going on again. In this cartoon, you see two people are pulling on the state of Utah for possession. One side are the developers, the other side are the environmentalists. And they're singing, "This land is my land, this land is my land." It's actually our land, I think. Okay, don't show it just yet. But the next cartoon that I'll have come up here, probably my most tweeted, Facebook, most famous cartoon worldwide that I've ever done. And the funny thing is, when I did it, I thought, no, I don't know, I'm not sure this is any good. But when I published it, it went, like I say, viral. And I started getting the cartoon back to me, translated into Arabic and Italian and Russian. And, you know, so it definitely hit a spot. So let's see the next one. Okay, this is the cartoon. This is the cartoon of Malala, the Pakistani girl who survived an assassination attempt by the Taliban. And her whole thing was education for women especially, education for girls. And it shows her holding a book that says knowledge. And the caption is, "What terrifies religious extremists like the Taliban are not American tanks or bombs or bullets, it's a girl with a book." And I just want to say that this is something that we all should keep in mind, you know, Republicans, Democrats, whatever, is that education is the most important thing that you can do for all of us, for our children, for all of us. Anyway, that's...
The incomparable Pat Bagley, everybody. Pat Bagley. Come on, come to the sofa. I'm going to ask a few questions, and then it'll be your turn. But Pat, I mean, these are such stunning images. It is so great to hear you talk about them and the stories behind them. As Terry said, this is about the power of the pen. The pen has been your weapon of choice. You've used it with precision. And in fact, in 2014, as Terry mentioned, you were named as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. I want to read just a little bit about how they honored you with this award. For his adroit use of images and words that cut to the core of often emotional issues for his readership. Well, what does Pulitzer recognition mean for you?
Oh, it's the gold standard. I mean, it's like, it's the Nobel Prize for journalists, right? You know, everybody aspires to it, but you don't really think that you're ever going to be recognized. So getting that close, and I guess a little background, is that they nominate three people for the Pulitzer out of all the submissions that they get. And they don't let you know who's actually been nominated, right? Until the day that they actually announce the winner. So you find out the day that you came that close. That you came that close.
As we're talking, we're seeing some images from history, past Pulitzer winners. And you've joined that elite group of editorial cartoonists who have been honored by the Pulitzer Prize board. Some of the images that you'll see up here, Thomas Nast, John T. McCutcheon, Herb Locke. As a developing artist, who were the editorial cartoonists that inspired you, that you looked up to?
Well, growing up with my family and having the newspapers, we had access to all the cartoonists, but it was Pat Oliphant who really, you know, captured my imagination as a kid because his drawings were funny. He came from Australia and he brought with him a very different way of expressing cartoons. You know, before then, cartoons were in a vertical format and you'd see a hammer, you know, hitting a thumb, and the hammer would be the Soviet Union and the thumb would be Hungary, and, you know, it was kind of blasé. But Pat Oliphant brought, his stuff was just hilarious. And he did great stuff about Richard Nixon. And he's one of the people that actually brought down Richard Nixon. So to recognize, you know, so as a kid growing up and seeing this kind of stuff, that really influenced me. And Mad Magazine.
Mad Magazine. there's actually a couple of Pat Oliphants, and one of which he won the Pulitzer Prize for. It's called They Won't Get Us to the Conference Table, Will They? It's depicting Ho Chi Minh, the North Vietnamese president. He is carrying a dead Viet Cong soldier and basically saying, we refused to enter peace negotiations. So many of these images, though, they're just pieces of history. And I'm wondering, as a cartoonist, are you thinking about how your image is going to be interpreted 10 years from now, or is it very much in the moment, like this Oliphant?
I just went through cartoons from 10 years ago, and I've changed, you know, over the time, and you know, I hope that...
How? Can you be more specific?
Well, one of the worst things you can do as a political cartoonist is look at your old stuff. I mean, so it was difficult for me to kind of go back and see some of the stuff. I mean, 20 years ago, I was actually fairly apolitical. You know, if you remember back then, George H.W. Bush was not a bad president, and followed by Clinton, who was also not a bad president, but both are fairly centrist, right? And so I assumed that we were on that course to be very centered. And then along comes George W. Bush, and America takes this hard right turn. And I got radicalized. So I think that my cartoons have a vitality over the last 10 years that they were kind of missing before that. They were okay, you know.
So your edginess comes with age?
Crotchetiness, yeah.
Crotchetiness. I like it. As you've noticed the change in you, what about the broader world of political cartooning? Have you seen that change in any way? Do you think it's edgier? Do you see its political influence either enhanced or diminished in any way?
It's changing. You know, the role of political cartoonists in newspapers is diminishing because I I'm actually the longest lived, still employed cartoonist by a by an institution yet living. Let me put, how do I express this? I've been at the Tribune for 36 years. There's no other cartoonist in the country now living who has been that long with their newspaper. Yeah. Okay. It's kind of like Survivor, you know, they all got thrown off the island. When I started cartooning and started working at the Tribune, there were maybe 300 cartoonists who were employed by newspapers. And now it's below 50. So that has changed dramatically. But on the other hand, with the web, the internet, anybody with an idea can do a web comic, a web cartoon. And so we're seeing a lot of vitality there. You know, the newspapers were having, you know, a tough time, but political cartoons are still out there, and some of the best stuff out there are by these younger web cartoonists.
If you were to compare your art to a style of music, what would it be? How would you characterize that?
Good question. It would be jazz, I think.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that you kind of go with the flow and the impression, and you know, one of the things that I like to do in my cartoons is to capture an expression with just a very few lines. And kind of like jazz.
Okay, well, too bad our film time-lapse video does not have a jazz soundtrack, I'm sorry to say. But we thought it would be really cool if we showed you Pat in action from beginning to end producing something. So take a look. Awesome, isn't
Thank
it?
You.
Isn't that great? So, from your concept till the finished product, how long does that take?
It's different every time. I mean, it's every time I go into work, it's like a high wire act. You know, I never know what's going to happen. Sometimes the idea takes all day long, and sometimes I'll come in with the idea already pretty much formed. Same thing with the execution of the cartoon. Sometimes it kind of flows and I'm really happy with it. Other times it's like I just can't draw. So it's always different. And that's one of the reasons I love doing what I do, because it's challenging constantly.
One thing that the video did not show was the color. How do you add color to your work?
So what they captured was me doing the line drawing, and then I scan that into the computer and I use Photoshop to add the color and to kind of clean things up. So my original cartoons kind of look like Frankenstein, you know, but I know because I can go in there and I can move this around and I can do this and that. If I don't like how I do a caricature of, you know, some politician, then I can just do another one right next to him and I can switch heads. So, you know, this is the, I love living in the future, you know.
So your cartoons are so distinctive. Here's one from, earlier this year, and I guess 2015. Some of Pat's best work is that you can see out in the hallway, there's an exhibit that's gonna be here at the Leonardo throughout the month of some of his best work, and there's also an online gallery. What were some themes that emerged from last year that sort of struck you?
Well, the run-up to the election came out fairly early. I guess some of the themes were just the I got to say it, the craziness of the right-wing media. It's just, you know, here we've got $2 gasoline. You know, the economy is going off all cylinders. The stock market's never done better. Employment's down below 5%. And if you talk to a Republican who watches Fox News, they're convinced that things are horrible. You know, and so, yeah, you're looking for a theme, it's that, is that despite reality, people can believe anything.
Let's go to the next one. Here's an image that is just so powerful. It's got a police officer and a young African-American man. They both have reflective glasses, and they see the image of each other in their eye, in each other's eyes, and they're completely different.
Oh, yeah, so the black kid, you know, he's seeing this KKK guy with a gun. The officer is looking at this black kid, and he sees this, you know, thug with tattoos. That was another thing that came up this last year, is that I had no idea that until we started seeing videos, and you can't argue with the videos, you know. You see police shooting unarmed people, and, you know, I think all of us can reflect back and think, you know, you hear these stories and you think, well, he probably had it coming. But then you see the videos and you realize, well, there's more to the story. So that's another thing that's come out this last year, is we started to see our fellow Americans in a different light, which I think is good.
Let's see the next one. Police officer with his gun just recently shot, "You have the right to remain silent," and a man lying on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, these are raw. These are visceral.
And I got to say, there's something wrong with us, because you don't have this level of violence in any other developed nation. I think that the number of people who've been killed by police in England, you know, you could start in 1916 and go to the present day, and we kill as many in half a year as they've done in a century. So there's something wrong with the culture. You know, we're very violent people, and we're just and now kind of coming to grips with that, I think.
People either love you or they hate you. No haters in this crowd. But I mean, how do you deal with the criticism? Because it comes in daily.
Well, I raised kids, so I'm used to it. Well, oh, I don't know if I can say it. I'll say it. When I first came onto the Tribune and I did a cartoon, and somebody wrote a letter that didn't like what I had done, and I was outraged. And I wanted to have space on the editorial page to write a response to this guy's letter. And I was talking to the editorial page editor, and he said the best thing that's ever, that I've still carried with me. He says, "Don't get into a pissing match." And I thought, okay.
Good advice, huh?
It was great advice, yeah.
Speaking of editors, has an editor ever shut you down?
I've had cartoons that have been pulled, sometimes for cause, I think. Other times, I think that they made a mistake. So it happens, but it doesn't happen very often. I've got a great position at the Tribune, and I've worked with great people at the Tribune, and, you know, very smart, enlightened people. And, you know, even if they don't like it, they'll go, "Oh, yeah, sure, it's, you know, it's your name is on it."
Your internal conscience, where is the line for you, though? Where is the line that you would not cross?
I guess that there are lines that I won't cross, but it's always changing because the culture changes. You know, doing the cartoon of the LDS prophet, you know, was a line that I crossed. And I had to struggle with that. You know, do I do this? You know, this is a figure who's revered, and they're going to see this as being sacrilege. But then I thought, well, he's out there in the public eye, and so he's fair game. Like I say, it changes, and it is something that you have to constantly reconsider. And I think, am I holding back too much? And occasionally I'll do a cartoon just to see if Tim is on his toes.
It's Tim Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, my editor. He is on his toes.
Let's go to the next one. Do you want to describe this for our radio audience?
Oh, yeah. So this is going from left to right, and there are five people. There's Ammon Bundy holding an assault rifle, and he's saying, "I am doing God's will." Next to him is the Baptist Church, the
Westboro Baptist Church,
and the leader of that, and he's holding a sign that says, "God hates fags," and he's saying, "I am doing God's will." And then next to him, you've got the polygamist, you know, with two...
Warren Jeffs
with two young girls that he's probably married and molested. He's saying, "I am doing God's will." And then you've got Kony, who was part of that Lord's army in Africa that's just doing horrible things with child soldiers. And he's saying, "I am doing the Lord's will." And then the last thing that you see on the panel anyway is the ISIS executioner saying, "I am doing God's will." You know, this got a lot of response, and I'm proud of it.
You do a lot of caricatures. When you are, say, you want to do a caricature of Warren Jeffs, mm-hmm. Where do you start? I mean, what features are you looking for? Don't tell me how you do my caricature. I already know which features you would prominently display, but I mean, what are you looking for when you look at somebody?
Oh, you know, it's just kind of a feeling that you get. Hard to describe. You know, I've been doing it for so long, and sometimes it just kind of flows. Here's something for people who are starting to do this, you know, kids. It actually helps to start with a small picture, small photograph. And for some reason, you know, when you're looking at a small picture of somebody, you do kind of focus in on those attributes that kind of stand out.
That's a great cartoon. Let's show one more. Do you want to describe this one?
Oh, yeah, this is that iconic, heartbreaking photograph of Alan Kurdi, who 3-year-old boy who washed up on a beach in Turkey because his parents were trying to immigrate, the boat foundered, and the reason this image is so wrenching is that we've all seen this with our, you know, children and, you know, nephews, and you walk into a room and they're dead to the world. And in this case, you know, this kid literally was dead to the world. You know, you just want to pick him up. And so you see that he's on the left, and then you see the world has his buried in the beach sand, you know, kind of ignoring
this. Head in the sand.
Yeah, head in the sand. You know, very simple. Not a lot of words.
What kind of response did you get to this one?
It's another one of those that went all over the world, and you know, people had a very visceral, heartfelt response to it.
You've shown us that there is power in political cartooning, but there's also, as you mentioned, a vulnerability because of the state of newspapers today.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What is editorial cartooning going to look like in 10 years?
I don't know. I think we maybe hit bottom. you know, I think the things have kind of gotten as bad as they've gotten, and they haven't. I mean, I used to hear every week of, you know, some newspaper firing a cartoonist, and that has slowed down. And there are actually newspapers who are hiring cartoonists. You know, it's kind of rare, but I think that we're kind of treading water right now. And to look into the future, I don't know, you know, slowly we are going to go totally digital, you know, whether we like it or not. But, you know, in the meantime, for the next 10 years, I think we will have a paper product, and you can still have your newspaper and coffee in the morning. You know, that it's a great sensory experience.
Pat Bagley is not going anywhere from the Salt Lake Tribune. Awesome. Awesome. Let's get some questions. You can either come here, or I will bring the mic to you.
Thank you, Pat. You've published several books, with Robert Kirby. There's one entitled "Pat and Kirby Go to Hell." In there is a nude portrait of Robert Kirby in the flames of hell. I just want to know, did he pose for that?
He's a beautiful man.
Too much information. Right over here.
I want to go back to your the last cartoon that you showed us. You know, the Syrian boy on the beach with the world, you know, head in the sand. This, I mean, this brought a tear to my eye. It was beautiful. It was spectacular. But I also saw this other cartoon by Charlie Hebdo a few weeks back. Similar picture, but the title was Things That People Do to Get to the West or something like that. When the attack happened on Charlie Hebdo, I was very sympathetic, but when I saw that, there was just, you know, it was disgusting. There were things that, you know, like you asked about, you know, what is the line that you cross? Mm-hmm. I was wondering if, you know, what are your comments on that? I wasn't sure if you saw the cartoon.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Well, the thing about Charlie Hebdo, I went to France a couple of years ago for a cartoonist conference, and I met some of the Hebdo cartoonists, and I had no idea who they were, you know, at the time. Somebody showed me the Charlie Hebdo publication, and the aesthetic is very different from what we're used to. I mean, Charlie Hebdo does offensive things to cross the line, to deliberately provoke people, because it has to do with their idea of freedom, you know, their idea of what we call the First Amendment, freedom of speech, is they think they should be able to say anything. And it's culturally different from what we're used to. You know, we see that kind of stuff and we get outraged and incensed. But it's hard to describe, you know, what Charlie Hebdo really does, because it's just different. I'm not expressing this very well. When I first read my first Charlie Hebdo, I go, this is just gross. You know, there's lots of nudity and you know, genitals and all this kind of stuff all over. But it's just part of their culture. You know, it's just we don't have something similar here. When I met these cartoonists from Charlie Hebdo, the most inoffensive people you could ever hope to meet, you know, and I really enjoyed their company. So I know I'm kind of dancing around an answer to your question. But all I can say is that I'm just not equipped to really address that. You know, I think that what they do is deliberately provocative, and they do it just to be provocative.
Humor is variable depending on culture, though, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, very much. Well, one of the things in Europe and the Middle East and most of the rest of the world is that they take their political cartoons very seriously. You know, and cartoonists in Iran and Egypt and Turkey are getting imprisoned and you know, thrown in jail all the time. The Syrian cartoonists have been, you know, killed, and they've had their hands stomped on. And you look at the cartoons, and we as Americans wouldn't quite see why that would enrage people, because, again, it's very different from our cartoons, which kind of relies on a lot of humor and gags. But in the rest of the world, it's a whole different. It's very different. You know, I don't worry about somebody gunning me down when I go to work, because in America we're kind of viewed as the entertainment complex, right? But in Egypt, you do a cartoon about the government and you could very easily end up in jail.
Yes, I'm curious, when we see cartoons in the paper from different cartoonists from around the world, how was that choice made, and is there any rhyme or reason to it when your cartoon is not there, or is there?
Oh, so part of my process is I go in, you know, 5 days a week usually, unless I'm on vacation. So I do a cartoon for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday. And so that means Saturday and Monday, we have to choose a cartoon from the syndicate to throw in, you know, my place. And either that's my choice or the editorial writer's choice, you know, which cartoon goes in there. And it's just kind of what strikes us as, you know, a good one to throw in there. So it's just, there's no rhyme or reason to it.
Apparently they miss you not doing 7 days a week. All right.
I noticed, I think, that your signature was kind of blocky in some of your earlier cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering why you went to the different signature and kind of what the story is behind that.
Oh, boy. You know, when I started doing cartoons, I was struggling with the style and trying to land on a style, and I tried different things, and I tried different instruments. I tried brushes, I tried pens, I tried different kinds of paper, I tried very fancy paper, and I ended up, after about 8 years, with typewriter paper and a felt-tip pen. You know, 99-cent pen, because it felt comfortable, but I experimented a lot, you know, in those early days, and I was kind of struggling. You may have heard this thing, if you do something for, 10,000 hours, you get good at it, finally. And so I went back and looked at it. 8 years is about 10,000 hours. So, you know, I finally found a style that I was comfortable with, and I've been, you know, developing that ever since.
Have you thought about or have you cartooned the hedge fund owners of the Tribune and their partners, the Deseret News?
That might cross a line. I don't know.
Yes, and it was not published. Do you want to hear what it was?
Other questions?
So it's one of these two-frame cartoons where they started delivering the newspaper to the edge of the driveway instead of putting it on the porch, right? And so in the first frame, you see this guy in a bathrobe, and he's out there, and he's saying, "Where's my paper?" You know, and he can't find it. And then the next frame is the hedge fund that owns us, and, you know, he's, you know, looking at some prospectus or something, and he goes, "Where's Salt Lake City?" So we're in a position where we're owned by people, by a hedge fund that owns multiple newspapers, you know, maybe 100 newspapers. They have no idea about the cultural significance of the Salt Lake Tribune or its history or the part that we play in the community. They don't care. You know, they're in it for the money. That in a nutshell is the position we're in.
Pat Bagley, uncensored. Other questions?
Like your cartoons and sort of harangue you on the street? Are you recognized by people who may or may not like your cartoons? Do you ever have people in your face?
Well, one of the great things about doing what I do is that my face is not on the cartoon, so that, you know, I can go and recognize. It's not like Robert Kirby where he's recognized everywhere. No. I like it that way.
Your typical drawing of a Utah legislator. I'm just wondering, was there a legislator that this was based off of? And if so, who it is or who it was?
Have you been to the legislature? I mean, it's kind of that well-fed Nordic look, you know. The great thing about that character is, early on in my career, I had to write the legislature, you know, on some guy, and it's hard to fit that many letters on a body. So now that I do this character, everybody knows exactly who I'm talking about.
Have you ever drawn a cartoon that you later regretted got published? It was maybe misinterpreted or something like that.
Oh, yeah. There was a cartoon that, it's hard to explain, but I did this cartoon that between the time that I did it and the next morning, something happened which completely derailed the meaning of the cartoon. And people thought it meant something that it didn't mean. And it's too complicated to go into, but I can explain it by citing Robert Kirby again, is that on September 10th, he wrote this column about flying a plane, you know, learning how to fly and how he would be so bad he'd fly it into a building, right? So between him writing that and the next day, all of a sudden it changed dramatically. And I did have that experience with this cartoon. And I had to go explain to, was it West High students? You know, no, I don't. It didn't mean you.
Right here. You talked about lines, and I was just wondering if you had ever considered doing a cartoon of Prophet Muhammad. Why or why not? What goes through your head?
Oh, I've thought about it. And I think that if I had a good reason to, I probably would. But the fact that I'm not Muslim and that we don't live in a Muslim country, it's not something that I think, you know, I've really felt compelled to do. I do live in a very Mormon state, and I did have to struggle with that. You know, do I do this cartoon about the LDS prophet? And, you know, again, culturally, it meant something, I think. If I just did this cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad just to provoke people, that's not good enough. You know, if there's a good reason, I probably would, but I just can't think of it right now.
I've observed since you went off to France and came back over the last several years that your work has gotten both more global and also more focused, whether it was a global issue or a local issue. Can you talk about how your perspective has changed over the last 2-3 years? Just because it seems to be coming out in your cartoons, they're so much more on point and just diving into the issues very quickly.
Well, geez, I didn't know that going to France did that, but well, another reason to go to France. I think over the last 10 years with the Iraq War and the financial meltdown and the Wall Street shenanigans, it's focused me. And, you know, if I can say anything, it's that, is that I do feel that what I'm addressing is important, that we're living in a very important time of American history, and it's important to get my message right, I guess. So, there.
Do you believe that there's a reason for optimism for the future, for your trade and for journalism, you know, high quality journalism, to improve, to, you know, for ownerships maybe to emerge that are not profit driven, that may be motivated by just plain good journalism, good cartooning, and, you know, with the digital age, aid that or make it worse?
Well, you know, with the onset of the internet, you know, I thought this is great because with a couple of keystrokes, you can actually find out the facts of anything, right? I remember having to research cartoons and going through back issues of the Congressional Quarterly and, you know, just to make sure that what I remembered was correct. And here we've got the internet that you can actually, you know, find things out just so incredibly quickly. But people don't use it for that, right? There's great journalism going on out there. We're doing great stuff at the Salt Lake Tribune. But a lot of the stuff that we do that's important is also kind of boring, that people don't want to get into it. It's much, much easier to read about the Kardashians than it is to go into this in-depth article about education in Utah. You know, so I have hope. I mean, there are great things being produced out there. But, you know, we're so easily distracted by bright, shiny objects. So I don't know.
Other questions? You said that you sort of got your start watching your father doodle in front of the TV. I'm just curious. You have two kids. Do either of them doodle?
Well, they started out doodling, and they both have talent, but for some reason, they just haven't followed up on it, and they're going in their own separate direction, which is fine. You know, it's their choice. They've got their lives and their passions. So,
you didn't discourage them and said, "No, cartooning really is not for you."
No, in fact, I've asked them, you know, recently, you know, why, you know, you see me doing this kind of stuff, why didn't you do it? And they go, "Oh, you're funny, and I'm not."
Right here.
If your cartoon shows up in the Washington Post or the New York Tribune, are you notified and are you paid?
So my cartoons are syndicated through KegelCartoons.com, PoliticalCartoons.com too. And that goes out to 800 different publications around the world. And I have no idea who picks them up and who publishes them. The only way that I'll know is that somebody may send me notice saying, "I just saw you in the Tulsa Tribune." But otherwise, I have no idea how far a cartoon is going. I know that, like I say, you know, my cartoons are being seen more than they have ever before. But if we could monetize that, that would be great. People are seeing it for free.
Other questions? Okay, well, right in the front.
So what's the timing for 2016 on the Pulitzer?
Oh, so, yeah, the mechanics of the whole Pulitzer thing is that they get together and they look at the different submissions, and there are probably 100 cartoonists who, you know, turned over a portfolio of 20 cartoons, and then they narrow that down to 3 cartoonists, and then they decide among the 3 who's going to get it, and then they make the announcement on around the middle of April. I think it's April 15th usually, and then you're notified. So
the portfolio is in, and mm-hmm. we did ask our readers for their opinions of what you should include. Can you tell us a few that you decided?
Well, actually, we've got the little display outside, and it's 3 different panels, right? The one that has Bagley on top, those are the ones that I submitted to the Pulitzer. Not all of them, but most of them. So you can see the ones that I chose from, you know, looking at your response to the survey. I had an idea of what I liked, but it was enlightening to see what you guys appreciated too.
Well, take a look at the exhibit. Again, it's going to be here at the Leonardo all month long. Thanks for some great questions. Thank you, Pat Bagley.
Can we say that we're selling prints outside?
We're selling prints. If you like one, take one home. Got to read some thank yous. Thanks to the Leonardo and KCPW. This event is made possible by a grant to Utah Humanities as part of the Pulitzer Prize Centennial Campfires Initiative, a joint venture of the Pulitzer Prize Board and the Federation of State Humanities Councils in celebration of the 2016 centennial of the prizes. The initiative seeks to illuminate the impact of journalism and the humanities on American life today, to imagine their future, and to inspire new generations to consider the values represented by the body of Pulitzer Prize-winning work. For their generous support for the Campfires Initiative, we thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Carnegie Corporation of New York, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Pulitzer Prizes Board, and Columbia University. Thank you, Pat Bagley. Thanks for coming. We will see you at the next Trib Talk Live. Have a good evening. Stay around. Chat with us.